I'm Anita Lustria, and this is Faith Conversations. Today on the podcast, I am delighted to have Dominique Gilliard. And this was a tough one to connect. So was last week with Jonathan Brooks. And so my thought was, then this is going to be really good material if we've had to struggle this hard. And as you know, many of you listened last week and I heard from you that you thought it was maybe the best podcast yet. And I'm in year four. So Dominique, no pressure. I have a feeling this one's going to be really great as well. And so let me just kind of enter in and give a quick intro. Dominique is the director of racial Righteousness and Reconciliation for the Love, Mercy, Do Justice Initiative of the Evangelical Covenant Church. He's an ordained minister. He previously served in pastoral ministry in Oakland, in Chicago, and Atlanta. He serves on the board of directors for CCDA, Christian Community Development Association, and Evangelicals for Justice. He has written the book Rethinking Incarceration. And if there's a topic that we need to rethink, it is this one. It's a powerful book. The subtitle is Advocating for Justice That Restores. Dominique, welcome to Faith Conversations.
Well, thank you for having me.
This is a huge topic, absolutely huge, and we are going to barely make a dent in it today on the podcast. That's why I wanted to get the name of the book out early, and I'll say it multiple times because I think people are going to want to grab Rethinking Incarceration so that they can move through this and think through some of this that you are talking about in the book. I want to find out, first of all, how this subject first intersected with your life. There's always a story behind why someone writes a book, why a particular topic is at the front of their minds and why they want to talk about it. And I know there's a story with you. What got you really interested in putting together a whole book on rethinking incarceration?
Well, it really started with the church's silence on the matter.
Yes.
Particularly growing up in communities where it was pretty normative to see people without brothers, uncles, fathers, and kind of feeling it without being able to name it. And then I read Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow.
Yes.
And she gave me language for what I was feeling. But then for me personally, the thing that really catapulted me into the writing process was my senior year in undergrad. I was studying at Georgia State University, and about 10 miles away from my campus was a stigmatized community known for drug trafficking. And a law enforcement officer went to a judge and petitioned for something known as a no-knock warrant, which is a piece of legislation that allows an officer to invade a premise without having to stop, announce their presence, or display a warrant before going in.
Wow.
Like they'd have to do in any other community. And the officer got the piece of legislation. Two nights later, him and two other officers came back to the home that he had said he had staked out and knew was the epicenter for drug trafficking in that community. And they came and performed something known as a dramatic entry raid, where officers are in full military grade apparel, and with shotguns drawn, they kicked in the door at 3 o'clock in the morning. The home was owned and occupied by a 92-year-old grandmother by the name of Catherine Johnston. And she lived alone. And when she heard the commotion, she thought someone was trying to break into her house and rob her. So she started to flee. Officers said that they thought she was fleeing because she was trying to flee the scene. They deployed 38 bullets and fatally struck her 5 times in her living room.
No.
After searching the entire house, they looked for drugs and drug paraphernalia and found nothing. So they were in a position, how do they legitimate what just transpired? They unfortunately decided to craft a narrative and then decided to plant drugs throughout her house to make it look like it was a botched drug raid. The case went to trial, and upon going to trial, the officer stuck to the narrative that they made up in the living room that day until they found out they were caught red-handed. And at that point, they confessed to the whole thing. They confessed to planting drugs in her house. They confessed to killing her without cause, and the first officer was found to have fabricated evidence to get the no-knock warrant to start with.
Whoa.
After all of those confessions, when sentencing came down, the officers were sentenced from a range of 5 to 10 years, which is just a fraction of the time that Katherine Johnston would have gotten if she would have actually been apprehended and caught in the drug trafficking. So at that point, I knew I had an ethical and moral responsibility to go advocate for legislative change. And what was really disturbing for me was that my I was a double major in undergrad, history and African American studies, and my African American studies professors were telling us as citizens that we had to step up and speak up and show up for vulnerable people who were susceptible to this type of institutional corruption. And I said, yeah, that feels right, that feels true, that feels good. But while my undergrad was 10 miles away from where this happened, my church was 15 miles away from where this happened, and it had absolutely nothing to say about it. And I said, if anything should be compelling me to stand up for the least of these and advocate for those being oppressed, it should be my relationship with Jesus Christ and not just my academic institution. So that's kind of what compelled me.
Wow. Wow. Okay. So this is what compelled you. Then what did you do? I mean, because I look at this, I even look at your book and I think, wow, this is so big. And I certainly don't know where to start. And I think, you know, I think my guess is many people have realized the weight and the hugeness of this, but somehow have been paralyzed or just chosen not to jump in, or because it does feel or seem so overwhelming, have been paralyzed by it. What's your sense? Maybe both.
Yeah, I think a lot of people don't even know what's going on, one. And then I think for a lot of people who do know, they do feel paralyzed. It does feel like a system that's too big to even make a dent in. And so I think for me, helping people to understand, well, first, the gravity of the moment we find ourselves in. Right now, we live in a nation where we have more prisons, jails, and detention centers than we do degree-granting institutions.
Holy Stromboli. More detention centers, prisons, and what was
it? Jails.
And jails than we do degree-granting institutions.
Yes, you can literally, there are literally more places where you can get locked up than you can get a college education in our nation. And that's never happened anywhere in the history of the world before.
Wow. Unbelievable. Okay. That's a big statistic there. Why don't you give us some history and some of the roots as we look at this, and then we need to move on and get to what the church can do, where the church is in this, and what individuals can do. But give us some background. Lay a little foundation here for us.
Yeah, so most of us are taught in our K through 12 education, I would even say undergrad education, that slavery in this nation was abolished in 1865. Mm-hmm. That's just not true.
Right.
The triangular slave trade was abolished in 1865, but mass incarceration is really enabled to continue because of the loophole in the 13th Amendment, which says that slavery in our nation is illegal except as a punishment for a crime. So what you have is that when the triangular slave trade is abolished in 1865, you have a 12-year period of black empowerment known as Reconstruction, where federal troops are sent down throughout the South to make sure that black people will not be stymied in their pursuit for equality. And during that 12-year period, you start to see the black community make significant social, political progress to the point that in 1865, when slavery is abolished, it's illegal for black people to know how to read or write. Mm. And 12 years later, when Reconstruction ends, 1,400 black people have been able to successfully hold political office throughout the South. Mm. So you see that there is this major thrust for equity. And so that should ask us the question, well, what stopped that?
Yeah, what happened?
And what stopped that was the Hayes-Tilden Compromise. And in that compromise, there was an exchange for votes, and in exchange for that, federal troops were taken out of the South. And at that point, there was this mad dash to rearticulate white supremacy throughout the region. And I talk about how that really manifested itself in three ways. First, you had sharecropping, which is debt peonage. Then you had the emergence of a group of laws known as Black Codes, which were literally laws taken from slave codes and reinterpreted in a way that they could be reapplied after slavery was now abolished. And then you have the evolution of the Klan and the terroristic practice of lynching. So what you need to, what's important to know, particularly with Black Codes, is that there were laws on the books that said, that really criminalized Black life to the point that there were vagrancy laws that said if a Black person was stopped and could not prove that they were employed, they could be incarcerated. And then you also had things such as apprenticeship laws, which said that Black children who were born to unfit parents or were who were deemed orphans would legally be given to their former slave owner. So boys until the age of 21, girls until the age of 18. And these legislations were on the books in many states throughout the South. And so what you had is this massive number of Black people who were being incarcerated. But, and then the question becomes, well, what do you do with all these people? Well, there's a new system that emerges called convict leasing. And because of the loophole, again, in the 13th Amendment, all these people who are incarcerated can legally be enslaved. And then they are, and they're shipped out to corporations and to former plantation owners to do the exact same slave labor for the exact same no pay under the exact same dehumanizing circumstances.
It was called convict leasing.
Convict leasing.
Wow.
And they were leased out to coal companies doing turpentine work, doing tobacco manufacturing.
Whoa.
The whole deal.
Back,
and
I
that
mean, back
system
to,
is legal until 1921.
Wow. I mean, 100% back to exactly what slavery was, just different language.
Yep. And I want to give you an example to show you the depth of this.
Yeah.
So in Alabama alone, we know that at least 200,000 African Americans were leased as convicts. And in 1898, convict leasing supplied 73% of the state of Alabama's annual economy.
What percent of Alabama's annual economy? Say the percent again.
73%.
Wow. Wow. Okay. All right. What historically? What happened next? I mean, this is just deplorable here.
Yeah, so historically, convict leasing is actually federally outlawed in the way that it was functioning in 1921, but it persists in our nation until 1941. Mm. And so then you have a few years where incarceration kind of stabilizes, and the next big thrust happens in 1971 with the launch of the War on Drugs.
Yeah, okay, and that I feel like I'm a little more familiar with that, and that might sound familiar to some listening to the podcast. So talk about that for those that aren't aware.
Yeah, so in 1971, when the War on Drugs is launched, there is a public survey that goes out asking people what is the most serious social issue facing the nation. 2% of respondents say that it's drugs, drug distribution and use. But in spite of that, Ronald Reagan launches this full-on assault on drugs, particularly in relation to this new drug that is just hitting the scene, that is really being depicted as this drug that is making people lose their mind and have this very violent criminal activity in crack. And so you see this, the development of SWAT teams and these new special drug task force, which are really aimed at stamping out particularly crack, but drugs in general, and most specifically in urban contexts.
I want to know, if only 2% of respondents mentioned drugs, I mean, what was the largest response on the survey that was ignored? I don't, it might not serve our conversation at all, but I'm just that I can't believe that 2% responded drugs, and then it was taken to be the thing that they went after then, after the survey.
Yeah, it's a really puzzling response to the public survey that they initiated. But when we talk about the war on drugs, one of the things that's really important is that we see that it led to an unprecedented rise in our criminal justice system. Mm. But particularly, one of the problems we've had about how we've had this conversation historically is that we've talked about the war on drugs and mass incarceration really as something that has really predominantly impacted our male populace and really have ignored the ways in which women have been caught up in the system as well. So much so that since 1980, the number of women in prison has been increasing at a rate of 50% higher than men.
Ooh.
But we just don't talk about it.
Ooh.
And one of the other things that we don't talk about is out of all of these women who are incarcerated, 80% of incarcerated women are mothers.
Oh, okay.
And so historically, we've heard this narrative about fatherless households.
Right.
But that narrative is about to shift, and we're about to start to hear about motherless households. And because of this, right now in our nation, 1 in 14 children has at least one incarcerated parent.
Wow.
And that number is only exacerbated by race and poverty. 1 in 8 poor children and 1 in 9 black children have at least one incarcerated parent.
Whoa.
And this is important because we know that about 70% of children who have at least one incarcerated parent will end up in the criminal justice system at some point in their lifetime.
Okay. All right. Carry us forward from here. Because this is important to hear. This is really important to hear. And I think very important to feel the weight of this. I think it's something that, day to day, most people are not thinking about, because if it's not your reality, you don't tend to be considering it and thinking about it unless you're actively involved in, maybe in working in inner city, working with maybe homeless population. Where I don't know. Fill in the blank. So.
Unless you're proximate to the pain.
Thank you. There you go. Proximate to the pain. That is the phrase, the operative phrase. I said this to you before we started recording today. I have a friend who I worked with for years at Moody Radio, and he just left his post there after 30 years and is now a full-time chaplain in Chicagoland area at Cook County Jail. And so all of a sudden, I am more proximate to the pain as I've been reading his reports and his prayer requests and his stories. And I have been in tears more than once reading about what, the situations he encounters. And also tears of what God is doing as well. I mean, I'm grateful to be reading about that. But I want to hear this side of things and what needs to be done, what can be done, but we've got to understand what has happened to bring us to this point first. So that's part of why I'm asking all of these initial questions. I'll let you go on your timeline. So take us forward, keep taking us forward in the story of what is what has happened in our country specifically and what is happening.
Well, one of the critical things for us to understand is the way that we've been socialized to link pigmentation and criminality.
Mm-hmm.
There was a critical study that was done by the Journal of Alcohol and Drug Education in 1995, and they asked people to close their eyes for a second, envision a drug user, and describe that person to me. 95% of the people surveyed pictured and described an African-American person. Even though there have been study after study after study that found that African Americans are not more likely to use or sell drugs than Caucasians.
Yeah.
But this is the way that we have been socialized to think about drug distribution and use through the media.
When you turn on the
nightly news, when you listen to music, when you watch movies, you are being socialized to make this unfounded correlation. And this is where, for Christians, for me, Romans 12 becomes such a critical chapter for us when it tells us that we cannot abide by the patterns and the logics of this world, but we have to be we're transformed through the renewing of our mind by the Holy Spirit. And we have to take seriously the way that our nation has discipled us, not in a Christian way, but in worldly ways, to think about race in ways that are really antithetical to the gospel. And so,
but we've bought in. We've bought in 100%.
We have bought in, yeah. And because of that, right now, 1 in 3 black men will spend time behind bars in their lifetime.
Wow.
And the number is 1 in 6 for Hispanic males.
And I guess I'm going to mention too, whatever the wording is, and not necessarily correctly assigned or number one. If there was a crime committed, the penalty is much bigger than the crime
it's
warrants.
More severe.
And or
falsely incarcerated.
Thank you.
Falsely
accused. Wrongly accused. Falsely incarcerated. So you've got both of those things at play.
To give listeners an example of what I'm talking about, because I think it can be hard to just hear that and be like, I don't believe that. Mm-hmm. So I was at a lecture that Michelle Alexander was giving, and she asked everybody in the audience, she said, raise your hand if you went to college. Mm-hmm. Virtually everybody in the room raised their hand. Mm-hmm. She said, raise your hand if on your college campus you knew someone who used drugs. Virtually everybody raised their hand.
Okay.
She said, when was the last time you turned on the nightly news and you saw a drug raid on a college campus?
Ooh.
She said, it's not that know that drugs are there. She said, it's not that we don't know that drugs are there. Huh. It's not that we don't know that drugs are in suburban communities or in executive boardrooms.
Whoa.
It's that we have made a choice about where we're going to wage the war on drugs and where we're not going
Where we're gonna and where we're not gonna. Okay. All right.
And just to tie that last piece up, another classic example about why we have the racial inequity that we have, particularly in regards to African Americans, up until 2010, the sentencing disparity for crack and powder cocaine was that the person who had possessed or distributed crack will receive 100 times more severe sentencing than the person who had an equal amount of powder cocaine. And they're exactly the same drug. They're just made a little bit different, and one has a slightly more intense high for a shorter time, but that is literally the only difference. And crack is disproportionately used by black and brown people, and powder is disproportionately used by whites. And so Obama said that he was going to fix that disparity in 2010 through the Fair Sentencing Act, but he only partially fixed it. So he reduced the disparity from 101 to 18-1. So there's still an 18-1 disparity on the books for the exact same amount of a drug. And the sentencing is just different. And so we see that literally race is baked into the DNA of our criminal justice system.
Okay,
and
so
leads to these outcomes.
Okay, so I don't want to get off on a trail that we shouldn't get off on. But I'll ask this, and you can tell me if it's immaterial. Okay, so former President Obama press up against people that where he couldn't make the disparity closer, or was that just what he chose to do and didn't feel he should push further? I don't know.
I don't want to get too much into speculation.
Okay.
So that takes us on a rabbit trail. That's a question. Yeah, that's a question worth exploring,
okay.
But I would rather utilize our time by talking about the fact that there's really 5 conduits that are flowing people into incarceration.
Yeah, I want to hear about that.
Yeah, the first one is the war on drugs, which we just covered.
Yep.
The second is the school-to-prison pipeline, which really looks at the philosophical shift in how we respond to adolescent misbehavior K through 12 education.
Yes.
And so we know that approximately 3.45 million students were suspended at least one time during the 2011 and 2012 school year.
Okay.
And approximately 130,000 of them were expelled from school. And approximately 92,000 students in that same school year were arrested on school property during the school day or at a school-sponsored event. Mm-hmm. But what's critical to know about this is 95% of those people who were arrested for nonviolent offenses.
Okay.
And so we're looking at how when you and I were in school, things, when we got in trouble, we got detention, mm-hmm. maybe in-house suspension. We're looking at those same offenses now being outsourced, where students are being suspended out of school, being expelled, or being arrested. I mean, think about the young boy in Florida just last week who got arrested for not standing up and pledging allegiance to the flag.
Yes.
So, I mean, we're seeing very trivial offenses being handled by law enforcement, which leads to an over-incarceration rate.
Wow.
The next pipeline really is the deinstitutionalization of mental health facilities.
Yes.
And
I knew that was a biggie. Yeah.
Yeah. So right now in our nation, 44 states plus the District of Columbia have more people who are locked up with severely diagnosed mental health impairments than who are receiving treatment in the state's largest psychiatric hospital.
Wow. Okay. Wow.
This problem is so bad that medical professionals in the field bluntly said that prisons are the new asylums 5 years ago.
Oh, wow.
Every year, there are 90,000 people who are legally designated as incompetent to stand trial, which means they don't have the mental capacities to even know why they're standing in front of a judge.
Wow.
And instead of giving them the medical interventions they need, we are incarcerating them and exploiting them for their labor.
Oh, okay. All right, keep going. Keep going.
The last two pipelines are the parallel pipeline to the war on drugs that just has not been coined as a war yet, and that's the war on immigration.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
And there's been an undeniable rise in the number of arrests for immigration offenses. Mm-hmm. So on the federal level, from 1998 to 2011, the increase in arrests for immigration offenses was 145%.
Wow. And that's just up till, what did you say, 2011 or 12? 2000?
Yeah, that's just 2011.
Yeah, I mean,
and so that number has continued to grow.
If we could only know those more currently, okay.
Yeah. And so, as a consequence, we all know about cases of children being separated from their parents at the border.
Yeah.
One of the things we don't realize is that in the first two quarters of this past fiscal year, 21% of the kids who were separated were forced to represent themselves legally.
Right. You've got 4-year-olds. You've got 2-year-olds. Yeah. Are you kidding me? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And one of the ways this conversation breaks down, though, is that I think sometimes we start to get into partisan politics nonsense, and we can start to frame mass incarceration as a Republican strategy, and it's not. This is a bipartisan effort.
Okay.
Both parties are implicated in this.
Okay.
And one of the primary ways we see this is that in 2010, there was a bad immigration mandate introduced by a Democrat by the name of Robert Byrd that said, on average, ICE must detain 34,000 people nightly for immigration offenses. 34,000 people nightly. And that's a congressional directive that's been on the books since 2010.
And why is no one addressing that?
And it's directly connected to our next and final pipeline.
Okay.
Which is the privatization of prisons
and
how lucrative private prisons have become.
Yes.
So 73% of people who are detained on immigration offenses are housed within private prisons. Mm.
And that is because the government has run out of the prisons that have been built, and so they're happy to have someone else build them, and they're funneling money to them then? Is that how it works?
Yeah, so private prisons don't come on the scene until 1984.
Okay.
The first one emerges in Tennessee, and it was literally a confession on the government's part to say, because of the war on drugs and that the intensity we're having to incarcerate people, we've literally run out of space within our state and federal facility to house people. So we need to hire a third party to provide this service for us so we can continue to incarcerate people at the same rate. Mm. Now, what we should have done is we should have questioned the legitimacy of the war on drugs. We should have embraced diversion programs. We should have said that you can't incarcerate yourself out of addiction problems. We need to provide medical interventions for people who have addictions. Mm-hmm. But instead of doing that, we decided to outsource the problem and continue to incarcerate people at the same rate. Mm. And what we see within private, prisons in general, one of the big things, let me stick with private prisons real quick. So the two largest private prison companies, and people need to understand these are for-profit industries.
Right, thank you.
The two largest private prison companies, the GEO Group and CivCor, which was previously known as Corrections Corporation of America, but because of the bad press they were getting, they tried to change their name. Mm. In 2011, they collectively made $3.3 billion. And in 2017, they made more than $4 billion. Mm. And one of the ways that these two companies make a killing is that they actually are not legally classified as incarceration entities, but they are legally classified as real estate investment trusts, which allows them to evade a lot of the taxation that they should be paying for their for-profit industries.
Okay. You know, we need pauses after all this to kind of take this in, but unfortunately, there's no time for that. And I will say this, that's one of the reasons reading Rethinking Incarceration is good, because you do have time to stop and really soak some of this in, because this is big, heavy stuff here. I just want to acknowledge that.
I wanted to address one more thing, and then I can go to the church.
Okay.
What we can be doing.
Very good. Yep. Very good. Yep.
So the last thing, people don't realize how much commerce is being made behind bars.
Yeah. Okay.
And how lucrative that makes incarceration. Mm. So when I talk about private prison being lucrative, most people don't realize that it's one of the top five bought and sold stocks on Wall Street today.
What? What?
Yes, people are getting filthy rich off of investing in the incarceration of our brothers and sisters.
Oh.
But on top of that, in prison labor in general, they are making everything from furniture that's on college campuses to police uniforms to license plates to they are functioning in corporate call centers, calling what we call to make reservations for things. One of the things that's really crazy is that you have men and women who are working behind bars who on average get paid 93 cents to $4 a day for a full day's work of work, who are working for a company, say, let's just say Boeing, because they also make airplane parts for Boeing.
Okay.
So say you work there behind bars for 15, 20 years, become an expert in your craft.
Yes.
When you get out and you go to Boeing and you apply for a job,
yeah,
oftentimes these men and women are being denied a job because of their criminal record. So it bluntly says your work is only desirable when it's exploitable. And so that's another real problem, because a lot of people are like, well, they should work. They should get job skills so they can come back and get jobs. Well, when they come out and they're denied a job because of their criminal record, that argument really falls down.
And I
when we think about
I just want to say this, and I think seriously, I think a lot of people think are still back in, I don't know, whatever year, thinking that all that's being made behind bars are license plates. I mean, most people have no idea that all of this other stuff is happening with incarcerated folks. Okay.
And when we think about this as the church, one last thing we should really know is that 1 out of 25 people who are sentenced to the death penalty is actually innocent.
Yes, I had heard that stat. Say that stat one more time.
1 out of every 25 people who are sentenced to the death penalty in our nation is actually innocent. And one would think that Christians in particular would think differently about the death penalty, yes. given that our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ was falsely incarcerated and put to death by the state unjustly.
Yes.
But unfortunately, enough of us do not. A Pew study did, the Pew Research Center did a study, and they found that white evangelical Protestants support the death penalty at a rate of 67%.
Wow. Wow.
And, you know, for me, that's just a failure of discipleship, because at the end of the day, what the death penalty says is that certain people are beyond redemption. And every single week we gather together, we preach sermons, we sing songs, and we pray prayers, thanking God that nothing we can do can separate us from the love of Jesus Christ. But then we go and we civically engage and support something that ultimately says certain people are beyond redemption.
I'm grabbing onto your phrase. It's a failure of discipleship.
Yeah.
Oh boy. Okay. Yeah. All right. This is big.
When we also think about this in regards to the Bible, I think we've really failed to grapple with the fact that five of the books of our Bible were written behind bars.
Yeah.
Like this is not something that is estranged from the Christian faith. This is intricately woven within the sacred text that we believe in. And, you know, and the text itself calls us directly to be engaged in the system.
Yes.
So when we look at Matthew 25, Jesus says that if you are a follower of me, you are supposed to be present behind bars. It doesn't say if you're a liberal Christian, if you're a progressive Christian.
Yeah.
It says if you're a Christian, you're supposed to visit those behind bars. And when you do, you're not just visiting the least of these, but you're visiting me.
Yes.
And, you know, I always tell people, I only had to write this book because we haven't faithfully lived into Matthew 25. We don't know because we don't go. And if we went, we would be shocked by the number of black and brown bodies who are caged like animals and being dehumanized on a daily basis in our nation right now. But it's not just that one verse. So Hebrews 13:3 also says that we are supposed to remember the incarcerated as if we ourselves were incarcerated, suffering alongside with them. Could you imagine the witness of the church if we were remembering incarcerated people like that right now in a moment where we have more people locked up than any country in the history of the world?
Wow. Wow. Let's come to the part where I think people don't know what to do or feel kind of frozen or don't hear this talked about in church. And maybe someone listening today, seriously, to this podcast or whenever they listen is going, okay, you know what, God is nudging me in a big way and I cannot sit silent. You know, I'm certainly hoping that's the case. One of my goals is raising awareness to the point of action. And so what needs to be done, can be done. What, you know, let's move into the realm of the church and even down to the realm of the individual. I'll let you go wherever you want to go from here.
Yeah. So one thing I want to make clear also before I go there real quick is that there is no gospel without incarcerated people.
Yes.
And I don't metaphorically mean that. I literally mean that.
Yes.
Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith. John, who wrote the majority of the New Testament.
Yes.
John the Baptist, who was called to pave the way for Jesus. Paul, who wrote the majority of the New Testament. Peter, to whom Jesus said, upon you I will build my church. Samson, Hananiah the seer, Joseph, Malachi, Stephen, Jeremiah, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, Silas, Junia, Andronicus. All incarcerated people. The scriptures literally fall apart without incarcerated people.
Wow.
And if God so intentionally chose to speak through incarcerated people, then why do we believe that God ceases to have that same desire today?
Yes. That's powerful. I mean, that's another one I just want to hit the pause button and sit with. But we move on. Okay, but that's
yeah.
big. Okay.
And so I talk about every church should be involved in at least one of four ways. So there's the work of prevention.
Mm-hmm.
There's the work of visiting and ministering to the incarcerated.
Mm-hmm.
The work of walking alongside with families who have incarcerated loved ones.
Yes.
who are now trying to adjust to life without mom, dad, brother, sister. And then there's the work of reentry.
Yes.
Every single one of these are very four tangible ways that the church could and should be involved. And when we think about the work of prevention, I'll just give a couple examples of what that looks like.
Yeah.
So when we talk about prevention, most people have probably heard that they take the reading and math scores of third to fifth graders to project how many prisons they'll need to build in the future.
What?
What we can do is we can go to a school and actually go to elementary school and say, hey, give me the list of students who are behind reading and math grade level in, you know, first grade, second grade. We want to work with the worst students in regards to their academic achievement.
Nice.
So we want to invest in them. We want to mentor them. We want to help them get up to grade level. The other thing that we see is that I encourage people to go to the school that's closest to you that has the highest number of students on free and reduced lunches.
Yes.
And to actually go there and find ways that your church can actually leverage some of their assets to create a more equitable playing field in regards to the educational process. Mm-hmm. Because in those schools, you're probably going to have teachers who are already underpaid, mm-hmm. who are then pulling money out of their own pocket to provide school supplies because they have inadequate funding.
Yes.
But the other thing we see is when we think about free and reduced lunches, we know that a lot of times those kids who are in that program, the only nutritious meal that they're going to get all day long is from school. But what happens when school is not in session for those students?
Right.
During holiday vacations, during the summer.
During the weekends.
Most churches, during weekends. Most churches don't realize that you can actually volunteer to be a summer feeding program, and the government will actually provide the food. Yep. They just need someone who is willing to actually house the program. And so in that one simple act, you can become a place where people are literally getting physical good news, like food and nourishment, and you can build the relationships that can allow us to actually give them spiritual good news. But you just can't talk to people about the gospel when they're starving.
Right.
You know, there's a whole list, and I actually am really excited to tell you, and I'll send you a link, and I'll talk about it briefly. There's a brand new small group curriculum that is available for this book, and it's completely free.
Excellent.
Completely free, and you can find it at walkingtowardslove.com.
All right, and I'll put that in the show notes of the podcast. Walking
towards
love. Say that again.
Walkingtowardslove.com.
So towards with an S?
Yes, towards with an S.
All right.
And it's a 7-week study. It's a video-based curriculum. And then at the end of the curriculum, there's a 20-point platform for advocacy and reform that shouldn't be hindered by partisan politics. These are high-level things that we should all be able to get around and support as believers. And I give you in-depth history and background of each of the reforms that I'm talking about are needed. So it's a 15-page document.
Wow. Okay.
Because I want people to understand.
Nice.
I'm not just calling them to something without a basis for it.
Yes. Yeah. Excellent. Okay. That's awesome. Okay. Thank you for that. Walkingtowardslove.com. Again, I'll put that link to that curriculum in the show notes, and people can find that on the website as well. Keep going here. It's interesting. I'm not going to get into this, but you also talk about initiatives that have been in place and if they've been good ones or not, or how helpful, because I know a lot of people grab onto certain organizations that maybe have big names and maybe they've done a great job, maybe they haven't, but maybe they just don't go far enough, all those things. You also get into that as well, which I really appreciate, because I think, you know, there's just a lack of knowledge, or we tend to just be given one pipeline of possibility especially at predominantly Caucasian churches. And you're opening up many different possibilities and pipelines of action. And I think that's really critical. You can't just have one.
Yeah, I mean, because it's critically important to understand how all these things work together.
Yes.
So, for example, in California, 70% of the people who are incarcerated in the state come out of the foster care system.
Ah, wow.
And so when I talk about prevention, another tangible preventative measure is that they've also done research and found out that juveniles who had at least one incarcerated parent or who are in the foster care system are most likely to get in trouble right after the holiday season.
Mm.
Because they come back to school and they're with their peers, and their peers are talking about these jovial times of love and affirmation they had with their family, and they didn't have it, and they're upset about it.
And big piles of gifts and all of this stuff, too, right?
So we, as the church, can tangibly interrupt that by expanding our definition of family, by creating space at our dinner table to invite people who we know are missing a critical loved one and say, we are going to be that new source of love and affirmation for you in your life. We're going to show you the love of Christ, not only through words, but also in our deeds and our intentionality. And so there's all of these ways that we can really interrupt the system. But I think the other thing that I really, one of the chief calls in the book really, is to move away from a kind of punitive, vengeful understanding of what justice is, and particularly God's justice, to get a more biblically rooted definition of justice. And so scripturally, we see that justice is not just about punishment. But justice is, God's justice is inherently restorative. God is in the midst of restoring all things, including fallible people like you and me, but also broken systems and structures. And I think that's the piece for evangelicals, that's our growing edge, to understand how the commission to actually be about reconciliation and restoration is not just exclusively about individuals, it's also about restoring broken systems and structures that then go on to break individuals and families and communities. And we have to take seriously the way that mass incarceration is not just breaking individuals, it's decimating entire communities. And so the work of restoration is about personal salvation and personal restoration to our Savior, but it's also about us actually living into the prayer that Jesus taught us to pray. So the kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. And in heaven, we know that we aren't going to have these systems of brokenness that are manifesting injustice, oppression, and death in our world in the way that we see right now, particularly in our nation through the system of mass incarceration.
Dominique.
So mass incarceration, real quick, I just, one more thing, just because I think this is important.
Good.
It's not only unethical, but it's also fiscally irresponsible. And we need to talk about the fiscal irresponsibility. So California has the highest rate of incarcerating person per year. And they found out last year that it costs more in California to incarcerate a person for a year than it would to pay tuition at Harvard for a year.
Whoa.
But not only that. Right now in our nation, we are a nation that prides itself on being a land of democracy and a place of freedom, and you're innocent until proven guilty.
Land of the free, home of the brave.
And, you know, one of the basic principles of our democracy is that you're innocent until proven guilty. But that's just not true right now. Did you know that 75% of people in America's jails today are there not because they've been convicted of a crime, but simply because they cannot afford to pay bail? So we literally are spending $40 million a day incarcerating people who have never been convicted of a crime.
Whoa.
That's $14 billion annually holding people behind jail cells who have never been convicted of a crime.
Wow. There's a boatload to think about here. And I think one of my questions to you, too, is this is a big, heavy message that you share over and over. How does this, how do you do that? I mean, you know, this takes energy just to talk about this because it's heavy. I think about, you know, what it exacts from you as someone who has been given this, burdened with this and you know, given this call to get this message out. how are you doing, and and really, what do you hope to see happen as people listen to your message, read your message?
Yeah, I mean, it does take energy, but I'm really actually encouraged invigorated because right now this is actually a really exciting time to be doing the work of reforming our criminal justice system.
Okay.
Because unlike a lot of other societal issues, we're actually seeing a lot of successes and victories right now in this conversation. This has finally become a bipartisan agreement that our system is broken.
Okay.
And because of that, I think the body of Christ has been able to like unplug their ears and actually hear this because it's not perceived as some liberal message or some extra thing that's outside of scripture. And the big thing for me, what I want my readers to look at is this is a deeply biblical issue.
Yes.
This is not about partisan politics. Yeah. This is not about some kind of liberal agenda. This is about us bearing witness to the gospel of Jesus Christ in a way that actually brings about redemption to a system and a structure that is defacing the image of God and brothers and sisters on a daily basis. This is about us actually affirming the fact that no one is beyond redemption. And that while some people have made mistakes in life, many of those people who are behind bars have sincerely repented of their sins and they have tried to turn back to Jesus. And when we don't walk alongside of them and support them and aid them, we become a stumbling block to their spiritual connection with God. And I want us to be people who enhance and pour into and disciple people, because one of the things that people will be shocked by is the number of brothers and sisters who are behind bars who are disciples actively making disciples.
Yes.
And I want people to know that just because somebody is behind bars, God still has a purpose for their life. God still seeks to use them and is profoundly using them through programs like a program that I'm connected to in North Park Theological Seminary, where we go and we partner with a federal maximum security prison here in Illinois. And half of the students in the classroom are students training for pastoral ministry, and the other half are people who are serving life sentences behind bars.
Wow.
And what we found is that we are getting requests from the prison that we're working with, and a few other seminaries are doing similar programs. They're getting requests from prison campuses that don't have a ministering campus to actually have men sent from their prison as prison missionaries to start church plants in other prisons to bring people to Christ.
Wow.
And this is just something that the vast majority of us, we have no clue that this type of thing is going on. And we have a very real opportunity to disciple brothers and sisters who are making disciples behind bars. But what we need to be ready for as the church is when those brothers and sisters come out, they're going to need somebody who's willing to walk alongside of them. And they're going to need churches who have done the internal work to actually destigmatize people who have a criminal record.
Yep.
In a way that we can walk alongside of them and embrace them and not try to love them from a distance.
Right.
Because you can't authentically love people when you're afraid of them.
Right, right on.
So we have to do the destigmatizing work within our congregation so we're ready to receive, empower, and walk alongside of our brothers and sisters in Christ who have met God and changed their lives behind bars.
Dominique Gilliard. You have given you're the one, man. You're the one with the message, and you can speak it well. You have given us a lot to think about on Faith Conversations. I am so pleased that you were able to be with us. Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you for having me on. It's been a pleasure.
And to everyone listening, I say, and this is a big conversation, I say, keep the conversation going.